are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. Before we begin, I'll remind you that Praxis receives support from the Smith Barbieri Progressive Fund, a charitable foundation. Information at smith-barbieri.com. Good afternoon, all you Spokaneites and beyond listening. I'm your host, Taylor, and today's Praxis is a Memorial Day show of sorts, which I did one last year on my own, and I'm glad to this year be joined live in the studio by four local Chapter 35 Veterans for Peace, who are now all published authors. So congratulations to all of you, who we'll meet in a minute, who have just produced a book, Vet Lit: How We Remember War, and it's just that it's literature, poetry, prose from different veterans about war. Since it's produced by the Veterans for Peace, you would imagine that it has a anti-war or peace slant, which is a slant I'm very comfortable sharing with them. So I think we might get a preview of the opening, the kind of release party, which is tomorrow, Sunday at 2 p.m. here in Spokane at the Community Building, 35 West Main. Yeah, so we're going to get a preview, meet some of these guys, talk about Memorial Day, talk about peace, and the rest. So I'm not sure who would like to go first, but if we can just do some roundtable introductions so that listeners know who's in the room with me, that would be great. And I don't care who goes first.
All right, I'll go first.
Okay.
My name is Nelson Lohim. I just moved to Spokane about half a year ago, and I served in the Army, two tours in Iraq. First Armored and in 5th Group. And I joined Veterans for Peace a few months ago, and just really happy to be with these guys and sort of share our ideas.
My name is Tom Charles. I was in the United States Army from 1968 to 71 and spent a year in Vietnam, pretty much all of 1970. I've been a member of Veterans for Peace since 2005, and Vietnam Veterans Against the War since 1971.
I'm Michael Stevenson, a native of Spokane. I served in Vietnam for 13 months as a forward observer for naval gunfire. Have been a member of Veterans for Peace now for, I think, 3 years.
Hi, my name's Hollis Higgins. I've been in Spokane for about 20 years now, so I consider myself a native. I do blue-collar work for a government agency here in town. I spent 18 months in the service, three of which were in a hospital. So I'm now, as of last year, a lifetime member of Veterans for Peace, very happy. Attended the Madison, Wisconsin convention, where we actually walked in the footsteps of 2,000 marchers in 1968. There was only 200 of us in 2013, but it was an exhilarating experience to do that.
And that actually might be, I think, a first question for Hollis, because a lot of my connection to Vets for Peace in the broad scale is through you distributing the paper, War Crimes Times, that Vets for Peace puts together. And that shares a lot of writing. So what's, and this is for anyone also, but what's the relationship between writing and storytelling and the Vets for Peace mission and work in general?
Well, I'd like to answer that by showing you my T-shirt, which simply states,
time becomes meaningless in the face of creativity, for listeners who can't see it.
So a lot of us are bound up by some things that happened in the past, and writing seems to help a lot of veterans process their experiences and move on to the here and now, whether it be art or writing. And we are blessed with all kinds of really good writers. And so the War Crimes Times, last issue was in December, and now it is called Peace in Our Times. So that's a new positive spin on it. And our upcoming convention in San Diego, August 5 through 9, will be themed Peace in the Pacific. So that's where we're headed.
Cool. And so how have people here in this room, obviously all of you wrote a piece for this book. Is it the first piece for any of you, or are there longtime writers in the room?
Oh, yeah. I've been writing for quite some time. I started probably like 10 or so years ago when I was in Iraq, actually. And it was just a method to sort of release. And then from there, it grew into like more prose writing. And that's basically what I write is prose, fiction and nonfiction. So for me, this was it's a newer kind of writing for me, sort of like a pseudo-essay. I've been reading a lot of Borges and all, so... it's new, but it's still, I've been writing for quite some time.
I think anyone interested in peace will find himself
of a writer. You know, whether it's writing to your congressman or writing papers that you might need to present to certain groups that are interested in Works for Peace. It's something that just happens. By necessity.
For me, this is the first time I've written for a publication. However, I love to write. I've journaled, seems like forever. I find writing very therapeutic. I've also come to appreciate the power of story, my own story, and writing it, speaking it. And also the power of story as others would listen to a person's story. The question is, how well do I know you until I know your story?
Yeah, and I don't know if, I want to offer a preview of sorts of the reading tomorrow. Do any of the four of you want to read your piece from the book, or should we save it and talk about the pieces so that people turn out tomorrow at 2?
I think a piece or two should be read today to give them a kind of a preview.
Sure, let's do it.
Go ahead, Mike.
This is titled The End Justifies the Means. The end justifies the means, we say, a greater good. A necessary act, justified because of end result. Killing, a most primitive and beastly behavior, needs to be justified. So we say, the end justifies the killing. Or does it? Saying something does not make it so. Killing people to make people free? Killing people to establish democracy? Killing people to keep people safe? Or is it to keep oil supply safe? But aren't people the end? People are what freedom and democracy and safety, yes, even resources, are about. People. Or so we say. So how do we reconcile killing the end that supposedly justifies the means? Or is it only my people who matter? Crazy-making stuff, this matter of killing, especially for us who have done the killing.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Does anyone else want to read a piece? Or can actually all, I don't know. Was that your piece, Michael?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. Kind of shows the lack of logic behind the whole. Not even logic, but just it's just a nonsensical pursuit.
Well, my hope in writing, telling my story, even regarding combat, in Memorial Day, other than the fact I was born on traditional Memorial Day, but we're here to remember the dead. That should initiate introspection and reflection, not just rah-rah more war, but what is war about and what is killing about.
Mm-hmm. I accidentally attended the Lilac Parade, a.k.a. the Armed Forces Torchlight Parade, for the first time in many years. I don't want to say I was tricked into it, but a friend of mine has a brother who's playing in the band, and she said, let's go see him. We ended up missing him and seeing almost all of the rest of it, and it was kind of a reality check for me, you know, to see people in my community cheering for this idea. At one point in my life, I think it would have just made me really mad because I don't like war, but it just made me a little more thoughtful and on the sad end of things this time around, you know, because we don't want to demonize the people who are involved in this, but how do we tell that different story? And I know that other Vets for Peace chapters around the country have been kept from joining such parades. That hasn't happened in Spokane, has it?
No, it happened in Auburn, though. And, of course, there was a civil action suit that was brought into the courts. The Veterans for Peace were banned from marching in the Auburn parade, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. And they brought a lawsuit through Washington State courts and were allowed to participate in that parade, but only after taking legal action. So, yeah, there's mixed reviews on that. I can only say that Veterans for Peace, let's face it, I think America does owe a great debt to its veterans. Look at the veterans of World War II. Where would we be if it were not for American veterans of World War II? Who knows? Germany, Japan may have won the war, probably would have. It would have been a different world, so to speak. But if we're really concerned about people, as we say we are, and about our veterans, we have to care about where we send them to, and we don't want them fighting unnecessary and illegal wars, as some of the recent wars have been. And that's one of the reasons Veterans for Peace exists, to protect our fellow veterans. We believe the most fundamental goal and of any veteran is to bring peace to his country and to his children. And if we don't agree on that, then I don't see where we can agree on anything. But that's what we're about. We believe that this policy that we're fighting now of continuous wars and trying to control other countries through military interventions. We've got over 700 military bases in over 120 countries. We just find that unconscionable. And we are opposed to that. We think a quick way to ruin our country really is to continue this policy of continuous war. So we're opposed to that vigorously.
Yeah, and Michael mentioned storytelling. Obviously, this book coming out, Vet Lit, is a piece of that storytelling effort. How else do you think we can interrupt this continuous narrative that really outside of the peace movement, outside of groups that are kind of support structures that I think we're all part of to some extent, that are vocally anti-war, you know, the broader culture is still turning out to the parade, as it were, and cheering for, you know, portraits of people who have died in war, cheering for the idea behind it. How do we interrupt that story?
Believe me, Taylor, we ask ourselves that all the time, because that's what we're about. And that is a dilemma. It is a dilemma. If you are opposed to war, then typically you're opposed to America's national policy and people I use suspiciously. It's a confrontational meeting often. So, yeah, I guess people can get calloused and hardened to visions of war and, you know, statistics and that sort of thing. But we have to find a way to educate people that, you know, this is really wrong for our country, and that peace is patriotic, and it is not just saving our country as a whole, but our children specifically, and the children of other countries as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned narratives. I mean, putting out stories as much as you can is one important thing, because you have to, at some level, I mean, like Tom says, it's very contentious, right? You tell someone you're for peace, and you immediately get eyed. And I think the idea is to slowly just sort of present this picture that's not being presenting, you know? I mean, maybe people are hardened to war, but I really don't think they are. They really are cut off from it in many ways. And so you can sort of try to show them the picture as best possible, as well as tell them the different stories. And I think, at least when I write, that's part of my end goal, sort of like telling these stories. That'll make people think outside of what.
Mm-hmm. I think especially in regard to the current, the most recent and the still current, and as Tom pointed out, illegal wars and occupations we're involved in, you know, that you're direct, you have direct knowledge of. I think that through a lot of storytelling and processing, it's generally accepted that Vietnam was a bad idea and was a bad thing that this country went through. But when we see, you know, we're getting the early storytelling from Iraq, Afghanistan, and it looks like American Sniper instead of like, you know, PTSD, and well, which is part of that story, I suppose, but it makes me worry for the, you know, our generation's kind of war narrative and what we're going to take out of it.
But I think even Vietnam in the general is the right lesson wasn't learned. Like, you can say it was a strategic mistake, but you can't say that it was a crime. You can't say any of these other things. And you can't point out all the, you know, the whatever, the millions that died and the, you know, the side effects as well. Or, you know, the. So I think even then, you can say it was costly. You can say it was bad in many ways, but you cannot say other things about it. So you still have to, even Vietnam, talk about, because many people are willing to say, yeah, that was a mistake because we lost in some sense. But they're not willing to say it was wrong from the get-go or the underlying mechanisms behind it. So
yeah, that's a good point. So,
but to go from Vietnam to Iraq was a traumatic event. I think we just did not learn from Vietnam. That was, you know, all wars are a little different, but boy, there were a lot of similarities in our entrance in there. And to enter a war like Iraq that was based on, you know, lies about weapons of mass destruction, I mean, and I think those were deliberate lies.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I try to do is, in visiting with people, is expand the narrative. A local psychiatrist in a forum on violence made this statement, and I think it is so germane to what we're talking about. He said, a shallow culture is a violent culture. And he went on to explain that statement. Not willing to think in depth or deeply, real, honest, critical analysis of the issue, the greater issue, not just my bias, not just my fears, not just my own wants or thinking, but expand the context. And so instead of understanding and dealing with the root cause of extremism, which produces terrorism, which happens to be illiteracy and poverty, we think shallowly. And what do we do when we think simplistically and shallowly? Violence is the answer. Kill them all. And it's far, far greater than that. So that's one thing I'd like to do in story.
Yeah. That would solve a lot of problems, actually, to just get a little deeper in our understanding. And I like to be able to do that here. I had a good, that's something also that Larry Shook, who I believe will be reading on Sunday, he joined me a couple months ago on the show to talk about his work around post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma in general. And that was, I can't quote him directly, but he said something similar regarding just trauma across our society, war being probably the most extreme example of conditions that inflict trauma. But yeah, we've just really got to slow down I think, our culture and think. Yeah. So if you're just joining us, hopefully we're making you think a bit. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. I'm here with four illustrious members of Veterans for Peace Chapter 35, our local chapter of Vets for Peace, Hollis, Michael, Tom, and Nelson, talking a little bit about an event this Memorial Day weekend, this weekend, tomorrow, if you're listening live, Sunday, May 24th at 2 p.m., from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Community Building, downtown Spokane, 35 West Main. It is free and open to the public, and you can purchase a lovely copy of this book, Vet Lit, that was just printed this week. It's the world premiere, and you'll hear many of these vets and writers reading their pieces, and you're hearing a little preview of that today. So would anyone else like to read their piece or a piece from the book while we're all here?
Well, I've got a new one that I just finally finished up due to this deadline coming up. But I've thought about this poem for a long, long time. I used to wake up and I'd have this dream. You know, we're talking about remembering war, and we have pieces that go all the way back to Wounded Knee. We have a poet that we're honoring, Wilfred Owen, and that's World War One. And I think a lot of our problems started with World War One. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and jeepers, criminy. We've only had 4 years without war in the United States since its conception. So how to break that cycle, and we believe it can be broken at any point. Is anyone's motivation at this point to answer? I'll read you a story from a dream that I had. It's called In Memory of the General. In my dream, Patton surveys the battleground. Green ruts cradle the wounds. Fatal, brownish mechanicals appear tossed and stained. A few black birds float above the smoke. How could you do such a thing? I hear myself say. The steel-headed general, crisp in khakis, replies with leathered lips, "It's what I came here to do." Stunned, the earth lay like a corpse. No grief for the loss of its small parts. Pain is part of the process, discovery, merely commonplace, a minor capitulation. Who fragged the lieutenant? Who mourns a molecule? There's a war on water here. Sound the alarm. Our souls are sunlight cutting through fatigue, crawling onto land still firm, solid ground. Who has the gall to take the world apart like this and that, to dissemble the parts, making weird shapes mashed together with droplets of super glue, only to witness a molecular march, an atomic horizon? I can't argue with two-faced logic, gripping my throat with fact-finding fingers, somber statistics which wash the world away until it's a thin stream upon which we all depend. What we want is that slow-baked grainy bread, bringing life back into the body spectacular, the mind embracing all of Earth, our creatures, generous, gracious, wholeness of being. Now I shudder at boys in camouflage, flipping that bayonet into the stuck earth, the boy that once was me, blowing up miniature forts with clods, BBs, paper out rubber bands. Yes, I scoff at returnees who placed themselves in harm's way for tenuous purposes. I wince at those who re-upped for another tour, stillborn visions of heroic deaths. All of us haunt the front lines of disaster, vomiting remorse and memories of the fallen as our soul grovels through the Arc de Triomphe, patchwork campaigns of unholy murderers.
Who goes there, old general, old warrior-in-chief, Mr. Vicious Patriarch? Not you, the least courageous of us all. What will it take to make peace with the world, to make you sturdy, strong enough to stand down? Who lies with you in the ditch, Mr. Sergeant? Poor boys, gutted for your implacable, metallic, ribboned reputation. Molded monuments to the scathed and flayed. All humanity calls out those mongers in the rear guard, generals in the turrets of the overview, the high hill, those who slay our land and our dreams. Make way for young ones, sweet and lovely and very beautiful.
Thanks, Hollis. That was, yeah. What, I don't even know where to start. It's really good. I love poetry, and I have it on my show sometimes, but it's, yeah, it's overwhelming because it's really good. So I don't know what to ask to follow, but.
Well, part of the thing that has come out that makes this a timely show is we have from the Sunday, May 17th edition of the Spokesman Review, Knowing Right. It's an article on page D8 about questions persist over Colonel George Wright's legacy. Was he a murderer or a hero? That's the question. Some very good points in here about that. And I just finally got around to reading it up today, but one thing that's happening is there's going to be a memorial dedicated at the Veterans Arena. It's going to be entitled Illuminating Courage. It's costing a lot of money, and there's been a lot of people involved. But there was a monument to George Wright over on the river. It was sort of an anti-war monument. But this article points out something very interesting about historical monuments. Every historical monument represents two time periods. Time to tell and time it was erected. By the 1930s and 40s, when the Four Lakes and horse slaughtered camp markers were placed, there's a real change. Indians are not a threat, so Americans can now be sad. This is a quote from Sebula. But what that monument doesn't say is how for 50 years the carcasses of those horses sat baking in the sun, how carcasses turned to bone, how bone bleached in the sun, how finally the river washed the slaughter away. It doesn't tell the story of how for the past 157 years local people have limped along trying to recover from the things Wright did to their ancestors. So the point is the monuments may change their meaning and their significance to our community. So our book is a slice of time that we say promotes the memory of a possibility of peace.
Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the announcement for the, basically the call for artists for that memorial, that they want a new war memorial for the most recent for Afghanistan, Iraq, this ongoing most recent war, which I don't even like to call it a war because it's really whatever. But and I remember I sent that to you and said, hey, any chance we can get a peace monument or an honest, a more honest or even just different look at it, something other than proclaiming war as heroism would be really great for that kind of monument. But it sounds like that's not what we're going to get.
Well, to tell you the truth, you are going to get a response because due to your inquiry, I sent that off. And this little brainchild of this book is our president, Rusty Nelson's. And he has a poem in there that just came out of him like lightning when he heard about that monument, Illuminating Courage. He's got a four-pager. He couldn't stop writing. And if you come to the reading tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the community building, you will hear In Memoriam.
Good, good. I'm glad if nothing else, a good poem came out of it. And we can, yeah.
Well, a whole book came out of it.
Well, you know, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for sharing your piece and for that, too. I was just talking about George Wright with a friend the other day, and I hadn't read that. So, yeah, she and I are discussing various ways to rename a street without going through the process of renaming a street. And that is much as I'll say on the radio, because it could be incriminating. But, yeah. So what are other people's thoughts on Memorial Day in general, with that being kind of the occasion of this? I don't know a lot personally about the history of Memorial Day, but obviously you timed it that way on purpose. So what do you think that holiday means to our culture, other than camping and barbecue? Because I think that is a big part of it at this point in time. But what does it mean to you personally?
I mean, to me, it's sort of simple. It is just, it's a memorial. It's for the friends that died. And it's just, it should be a sad holiday, if that's that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. It is a way to pay our respects to those that gave everything they had for a cause that they felt to be true and just. And yeah, what more can you say?
Interesting article in the recent issue of the Inlander. The current one, May 21st through 27th, on the last page, called The Last Word, we have an article by Lael Henterly, and it's called Marine for Life. On the eve of another Memorial Day, one local Pearl Harbor survivor retells a story that will never be forgotten. And he's standing next to the Purple Heart Memorial down at the Veterans Arena. And there's a picture of, looks like the Oklahoma being blown up at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. But this quote really stands out to me in the whole article. He says this: "The real story of what happens when America goes to war will never be found in the memoirs of the officers or the politicians who planned and organized the battles." Oh, this is Carol Edgman Hipperson, who wrote that, the Spokane author of Radio Man, an eyewitness account of Pearl Harbor and World War II in the Pacific. She says, "It's in the memories and the nightmares of the young men and women who fought them."
Yeah, which is something your poem was alluding to as well, right? That I can't remember the exact line, but basically saying, the big shots are never going to go.
Yeah, you see Patton in the movie, he's standing there overlooking the battlefield, and it's all green and smoky and dead, and he's wearing his bright poly silver helmet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I have a piece. It's going to take probably 4 minutes. Is that acceptable?
Yeah, quite. We've got about 20 minutes, so we're good.
You're going to follow this, aren't you, Nelson? It's called First Kill. 42. Congratulations, you got two of them. In the middle of the night, this voice from the past echoes in my mind, while sleepless, remembering, reliving that first kill. Congratulations for killing someone, as if it were special and deserved accolades. How we express our love of violence, saying it is necessary, noble, great, and deserving congratulations. Words revealing what we value as a culture, a society, a nation, even a church, an ideology and theology. Glorifying and rewarding with honors and medals, praise and promotions, the killing of others. Proud of our war machine, the world's largest, the most powerful, this American way of death. rationalizing our behavior, confirming our beliefs, convincing ourselves while deceiving ourselves that we are righteous as we worship the blood god of war. The glory of killing, spoken from mountaintops, yea, preached from the pulpit, couched in acceptable terms, wonderful patriotism, pride of nationalism, glorious sacrifice, keeping us safe and doing God's will. We kill to stop the fanatics, driven by fanaticism ourselves, praising our brand of violence, willfully ignorant of our complicity in the tragic results of exploitation through lust for power and resources, creating poverty and illiteracy, the roots of extremism that produce terrorism. Oh, but we do need to kill them, so we transform the killer into a hero with parades and fireworks, speeches, movies and war games, sending him off to kill and be killed. No hero I, but a pawn, used and exploited, now with blood on my hands, an ache in my heart, remorse to be borne. Other voices speak from the silence, heard by me alone, voices I cannot refute, truths I cannot deny, that I have done your killing. Do you who have not killed hear these voices? Or if you hear them, can you understand? Understand when I killed for you, I killed something of myself. Can you comprehend this reality? Or do you even care? These voices resonate in my soul, asking, who were these killed? The nameless, the other, the enemy, collateral damage, targets, depersonalizing terms, shameful euphemisms that deaden conscience so the faceless do not matter, so their voice will not be heard. But I see their faces, faces of persons, not things. When that voice from the past speaks, I see other faces also, faces of those who bade me kill, faces of those who killed, faces of those who justified the killing, faces now screaming we must kill again and kill more and more. Demons dancing in the dark come to these faces, entwining in death's embrace, they move together, while alone I grieve.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for reading.
I love that line. I love that line, demons dancing in the dark. That's so impactful. I can't stop thinking about that.
Yeah, beautiful.
Did you have one on deck, Nelson? You look like you do.
All right, book so open. I have one on deck. It's a short story called War Library. How do I remember war? How to remember war? Odd thing is, I didn't always want to remember war. Probably still don't, but there was a moment when I tried to remember. I'm not even sure what set it off, this little search for the past, but it had to do with an event, an ambush, about which my friend and I disagreed. I'm not even sure what aspect of the ambush we were arguing about that got me so riled up. Hell, or even if it was about an ambush. It may have been about the entire war, wrong or right, up or down, demon or savior. Christ, the things we argue. There was nothing on the internet that could provide the answer, and asking at the local library sent blank stares my way. I visited larger libraries in neighboring cities, and in some infinite musty stack, I found a historical book that gave a hint as to where I could find the needed information. The book contained a map to some nondescript building in the middle of nowhere. There was a label on the building, War Library. 1 week later, with a handful of topographical USGS maps, a compass, and a backpack, I found myself hacking my way through some of the most god-awful brush in the world. I spend whole days just trying to move a couple feet. After a few days, the air growing denser, my food supply running low, the smell of plant decay filling my nostrils, my hands ripped by thorns, my back half broken, and my hope thoroughly dismantled by the shadows which followed me. Just as I'd lost all hope, I heard a soft whistling song. It was not a sound of nature born. Soon, I was in a clearing pierced by slabs of sun. I sought what was causing the sound, a steel statue with an angled top and a hole, allowing the wind to flow through and make the soft whistling song I heard. The statue was surrounded by statues of men and women of all races and ages dancing around and having a party. Though I wasn't sure what this meant or if it had anything to do with the war library, I felt invigorated enough by the beauty of man-made polish that I went back to hacking my way through the brush. I found another song, run by the wind pushing the fans of a studded cylinder over a series of metal tongues of varying sizes. The music jammed such a melancholy down my throat that I had to sit for a few minutes to digest it. The statues here, the same characters as before, were no longer dancing. Instead, they stood around with worried looks on their faces, some looking at each other and others looking in the direction I was headed. The latest revelation cut into my confidence. After all, what were so many statues doing out here in the middle of nowhere? I won't lie, as I trudged forward, a sinister feeling started to gnaw its way at me. By the time I got to the next set of statues, the music even more ominous than before, the statues all filled with horror, some grabbing their throats, some falling to their knees, and others trying to run away, I was filled with a grim fatalism. I kept on marching, though, trying to twist my disquiet and use it as a weapon. I raced past the next few series of statues and music, all presenting more and more advanced stages of dying or death. By the time I got to the stairs of the war library, I was jumping at every sound, dead certain that I'd fallen into some rich man's snuff film. At the top of the stairs was an old man pushing a broom. If I was overjoyed at seeing another human being, he certainly was not. I asked him if this was indeed the war library. He spat and asked what the hell I was doing here. I mumbled something about my argument. He asked and asked why I didn't come the other way. He pointed to what was the other entrance some distance away. I looked. It was a glittering entrance with a road leading off into the forest. I hadn't seen the road on the map, must have overlooked it, but there it was, sure as day. And all around the entrance were grand statues of heroes and heroines, striking bold poses. There were even some tourists. A camera flash went off, a pinpoint of light at this distance. I told him I hadn't thought of going through there. Would my question be answered here? The old man looked me over again, claiming that I must certainly be the dumbest person to come through here, and he had seen some in his day. Didn't I see the statues on my way here? What fool would walk past those? Taken aback, I launched into the details of my argument, hoping that the guardian would help me. The old man listened, scratching his stomach. When I finished, he spat on my shoes. I cursed him out, stopping when I saw a mean glint in his eye. One look at the entrance here, with his low height and muddy floor, and I knew I would need his assistance. I apologized and asked for his help. He shook his head and launched into a story about a boy he knew as a kid, a boy who asked too many questions. The townspeople grew wary of his questions, and when they couldn't stop him with punishments, they told him about a sage who would be able to answer all his questions. So they gave him a direction, made him pack all his belongings, and sent him on his way. Off he went, the boy, happy to be finally on his way to finding real answers to his questions. Soon, he was in a cold forest and came upon a woman who had a bird in one hand and a bag in another. He asked her what she was doing, and she said that she was capturing the bird song. He asked her about the sage, and she told him that there was a sage much further along, and that when he met the sage, he would have to give him a songbird's song to get any answers. She would sell him the one she had for a few pieces of gold. The young man agreed and left with renewed vigor. He then found a man who sold him fog and another who sold him moonlight, and by the time he had nothing else, he didn't care for that, for he would have something worth much more, knowledge. And the day finally arrived when he came upon an old bearded man sitting on the top of a mountain, meditating and smelling like roses. The boy, now a young man, asked that man if he were a sage. The old man nodded and asked what he had to offer. The young man said he had a songbird song, fog and the moonlight. The sage impressed asked to see. But when he opened the bag to look inside, he burst out laughing, spittle flying everywhere. The young man, confused, looked into the bags and saw that it was empty. He left to the laughter of the sage and returned to the village. He no longer asked questions. I looked around when the man was finished with his prattle, wondering if he were mad, or just a lonely old man who wanted to talk. His eyes emitted at least the vestiges of intelligence, so what was he trying to get at? He too looked around, moving his jaw, expecting me to say something about the story. I smiled politely and nodded my head. I asked if this entrance would be the way to my answer. He looked at me for a few moments, and as his fell fell into disappointment, he shook his head and called me a fool. Nevertheless, he pushed the door open for me, warning me about the booby traps. Booby traps? It was pitch black inside. When I asked him for a light, he said I wouldn't be able to choose the light. Right. Now that I had proof of his madness, I tried to ignore him and peered further into the darkness of the library's cavity. The smell of books deteriorating hung heavy in the air. I looked back at the old man who was watching my every move. I jerked my head back to the building when the sound of metal scraping marble cut into my eardrums. There, far down the hallway, was a gallant woman dressed like a Greek goddess. She rode upon a metal sleigh with what looked like like a barbed wire whip in hand, and many naked groaning men pulling the sleigh. I blinked, and the apparition was gone. A lump started to grow in my chest. The old man stood there staring at me, a large grin on his face. I was soon making the hike back to civilization, ignoring the silly statues and trying hard not to think on the madman and his magic tricks.
Awesome. I'm assuming that the story was yours.
Yeah, that's my story.
Okay. It's awesome. I really like a lot of the imagery in there.
Thank you.
Yeah. If you're just joining us and wondering what you've been hearing poems and stories about, you're listening to Praxis, sitting with four Vets for Peace members locally, Nelson, Tom, Michael, and Hollis. Nelson just read his story, War Library, and before that, Michael read his poem called First Kill. And you can hear these and many more pieces read tomorrow, Sunday, if you're listening live, at 2 p.m. at the Community Building, downtown Spokane, 35 West Main. I'm really glad these guys have been here to do a pretty awesome Memorial Day show with me, talking kind of about the side of war that isn't, flag draped and fireworks and trumpets and all that, as we usually hear. So, what is all of your hope for releasing the book? We talked a little bit about storytelling at the top of the hour, but how would you hope that everyday people in Spokane could engage with you in your work and with this project specifically?
We meet every second Wednesday at the Community Building at 6:45. Anybody wants to work with us for peace, we have a lot going on, many projects. We have a project on informing school kids of their rights and responsibilities as far as joining the military. We call it Truth in Recruitment. And we're not the only ones. This is a nationwide program, may be under different names, but we are now at the point where we may be taking some legal action to get into District 81 to meet the students and pass out materials. We are also working on the environmental damage caused by Fairchild Air Force Base. Many of you may not know, that is a Superfund cleanup site out there. And also, some of us are working on the KC-135 Stratotanker. It's due to be, in 2017, the skins have to be replaced on those Stratotankers, the old ones, and that's going to be an expensive project. But each time you look up in the sky and you see one of those little four-engine planes up there, four jet engines roaring past you, remember, it costs $12,000 an hour for those things to fly. There's three crew members. And so what do you think your taxpayer dollars could better be spent? But we have other projects going on, and you're free to start one. We've got one fellow that's trying to form a peace institute. He's not a vet. He's an associate member. You can be an associate member for $25 a year with the national organization. To be a veteran for peace, you have to submit your DD-214 discharge paper, and it's $40 a year to the national. We charge $10 a year local dues, but we never collect them because everybody's already putting in money.
A lot of time, too, it sounds like.
Yeah. We've had booths at some events. We now have 60 people on our mailing list, email list, and we try not to overwhelm them with stuff. But mm-hmm. That's just a few of the things that we're doing. Anybody want to add some more?
One hope I have is that this could be part of an education piece. I think change comes through education, educating oneself, like we said earlier, a broader context, more in depth. And also along that line is that our young people are students. I am troubled that military recruiters get a red carpet welcome into our high schools, mm-hmm. and we perhaps we could say the other voice are really not welcome. And yet, I look back, I was in high school and the Marine Corps recruiters came in and those dress blues are pretty striking. So, yeah, and the rest is history, as they say. But to me, reaching our young people, and if this could be introduced by some instructors just to read and consider and dialogue, I think that could have results, and it starts one by one.
Mm-hmm. Again, America prides itself in freedom of choice, but you cannot make a free choice unless you have a well-informed choice. And that is our goal, to give people information and our young people information too about military service. And that is not happening right now, mm-hmm. to young people. You can ask them. They get one side of the story from recruiters, and they do not get another side of the story. So we are doing our young people a great disservice. We hope to correct that.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you all for doing that truth and recruitment work. Being veterans, I think, lends you an air of credibility that I know I, as one peacenik in my group of male friends in high school could not do. And, if that becomes a more present message in the high schools, I think that it can, you know, save people's lives and their minds, if nothing else. So thank you for doing that. But, yeah. Does anyone have anything they want to add before we close? We've just got about a minute left, minute and a half.
Well, I was reading the New Yorker for April 6th, and there's an article on the Nazi concentration camps. And the fellow here, whose name is Adam Kirsch, reminds us that if we're just going to look at gruesomeness and misery, then that would be counterproductive. So he says this. Looking at the concentration camps, he says, such sites raise the question of why exactly we read about the camps, or war as well. If it's merely to revel in the grotesque, then learning about this evil is itself a species of evil, a further exploitation of the dead. If it is to exercise sympathy or pay a debt to memory, then it quickly becomes clear that the exercise is hopeless. The debt is overwhelming. There is no way to feel as much, remember as much, imagine as much as the dead justly demand. What remains as a justification is the future. The determination never again to allow something like the Nazi camps or war to exist.
Awesome. And I think that is a perfect place to close. Thank you all for joining me in the studio. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, talking with Nelson, Tom, Michael, and Hollis of Vets for Peace, Chapter 35. You can meet them all in person if you'd like to for a Memorial Day event tomorrow, Sunday, May 24th, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Community Building Lobby. That's 35 West Main. I will post a link to that event on my Facebook page for this show, facebook.com/praxisradio. You can also find it in the notes for the podcast, which I will post right now at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. You can find all this information at kyrs.org. And I hope to see you there. Thanks so much for joining me. Thank you all for joining me on the show today. And I'll be back live next week.